Ananta koti vaisnavindi ki jai. This confounded Tara Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Prem school Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda. Sri Advaita Gadadhara Srila Sarivoa Bhaktivindi ki jai. Sri Sri Radhakrishna Gopinath Saimakunda Radhakunda Giri Govardhan ki jai. Sri Vrindavan Dham ki jai. Sri Dham Mayapur Navadip Dham ki jai. Gangamayi ki jai. Jamunamayi ki jai, Bhakti Devi ki jai, Tulsi Devi ki jai, Samaveda Bhaktivindi ki jai. All glorious here assembled devotees, all glorious here assembled devotees, all glorious here assembled devotees, all glorious to see Sri Guru and Gauranga Nithai Guru Primanandi Hari Hari Bo. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale, Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminathana. Namaste Saraswati Devi Guru Hung Kutsarana Vyasesa Sunya Vadi Vaskati Deja Tarane Om Aganatimidandasya Vinodana Salakaya Chakshu Samiratan Dena Tasmai Sri Guru Vedi Sri Chaitanya
It feels like a kibbutz.
I can't remember where I was up to in my prayer now.
Om Ganatami Landasya Janakya Sarakaya Chakshu Samilatan Jaina Tasmai Sri Girave Nama Sri Chaitanya Manavistam Stapitam Jaina Bhutale Sayam Nipakadamayam Dadati Sautanandikam Mancha Kapitsubhyasya Kripasan Vayavata Pitam Kavinabhyo Vaishnavayavata
Wide blue monster again. You can't see him, but look. Imagine if he was facing you all the time. Yesterday, we began hearing about how Krishna left the land of Vrindavan. Of course, Krishna never actually leaves Vrindavan, we say, of course. But there are many reasons why he never actually leaves Vrindavan. And the prime reason is that Krishna is Bhakta Vatsalya. Aishwarya Madhurya Karune Sarupa Purnata. That means that Krishna is he's full of opulence and full of mercy. This is what it means that he's the Supreme Lord. Usually when we think of the Supreme Lord or God, he's obviously going to be possessing all power and all opulence and also all mercy. Sarupa Purnata means complete, and Sarupa means his own nature, his own form, possesses these qualities of all power and all mercifulness. But Bhakta Vatsalya, his prime quality, foundational quality, is Bhakta Vatsalya, which means that he is very partial to his devotees. Samoham Savabhuteshu Name Dveshos Tinapriya. He is equal to everyone. Ye Bhajantito Mambhatya Mayatitesha Sapyaha. But he is especially inclined to those who are inclined towards him. So Bhaktivatsalya Atma Parjanta Vajanyata. He leans towards his devotees. His inclination is to the devotees. So the residents of Vrindavan, their specific qualification for being in this, what I think of as the most intimate private quarters of the king. Like the king has, he has his courtroom where he meets all the citizens, and he's sitting on his throne, and it's very formal. And if you've ever been to Delhi in the Red Fort, you see the darbar, or the courtroom, is the king's, the throne where he meets the citizens. It's very high. So naturally, when you enter in and you have his audience, you're like this. And if you're like that, you're immediately like that. You're very reverential, because it's required, because he is the upholder of law and justice and the order of the whole country, the whole area. So there has to be reverence and respect for his power. Otherwise, the citizens were all in chaos. But then at some point in the day, the king will stand up. And when the king stands up, all the guards and everyone stands up. And then he walks to the door, and the guards open the door. He walks out, and he closes, and the doors close. No longer is he in his official position, and then he walks into his private quarters, and he can take off his crown. He's still the king, but he takes off his crown, and he begins playing with it. He eats something. He plays with his children, his grandchildren. He jokes with his wife. This, that. He relaxes. And it's not that he's a different person from the king in the court, but this is just an aspect of his personality, a very private and intimate aspect of his nature that he can't display publicly. Because even though he's the king and he possesses full power when he's in his private quarters, at any moment he can order the armies to attack or this or that. But he can't display this very intimate part of his personality in the court. Why?
Because the citizens can't understand it.
Or they'll misunderstand it. What will they think? He's just like us. And then they won't listen to him. And which is bad for them. So regular, we'd say ordinary religious worship, drawing the parallel, the metaphor, is so much full of awe and reverence. But then in the private quarters, or in intimate relationship with the Supreme Lord, where only the most trusted lovers of the king or of the Lord are allowed to enter, then he can display the more intimate parts of his personality. And Vrindavan is the inner quarters, the inner chambers of the Supreme Lord, where he can be himself. He can just do what he wants to do with his most beloved and intimate servitors. And they're there because they're completely trusted. And why are they completely trusted? They won't misuse their intimate knowledge of what he does, because they are there and they're trusted because of their unalloyed pure love for the Supreme Lord. So that is the so to speak, prerequisite for entering into the private quarters. No outsiders can enter, but only the most trusted lovers of Krishna can enter into Vrindavan. And astoundingly enough, What does Krishna do in his private quarters? He takes off his shoes and he herds the cows, and he just in a perfect village atmosphere that's very, very simple. And he just he deals. He carries on intimate dealings with friends, with parents, with servants, with lovers. And this is what it's like. And it's all on the completely spiritual platform. So what's the difference between the spiritual platform and the material platform? Krishnendriya, Priti, Icha, Dari, Bali. Whoops, I got it backwards. Atmaendriya, Priti, Vansa, Dari Bali Kam, that when I am the center, Atma Endriya, my senses are meant to be pleased, that I'm the center, that is, then all the dealings, regardless of what they externally appear like, all dealings are Kam, or self-centered, or lust. And then on the other hand, Krishnendriya Priti, Icha, Bali Dari, Premanam, Dari Premanam. It is called love. Actual love is selfless, completely selfless. It's the activities, the engine driving, the activities in love are for the pleasure of the beloved. And the no matter what they appear like externally, what's driving it is the pleasure of the beloved. And in the opposite, in selfish activities, regardless of what it appears like, what's driving it is self-centeredness. So Vrindavan is specifically characterized by its selfless love, spontaneous, natural, selfless love for Krishna. It is completely spontaneous. No one has to think, well, what's right or what's wrong? Should I do this or shouldn't I do that? Who will say what about what I do? No, it's the engine again that's driving the activities in Vrindavan is the love of the residents of Vrindavan. And that's the spiritual world. And it's spontaneous. And it's completely, the Sanskrit word is swabhavika. It is completely natural. It's completely natural. They don't have divided minds. Oh, should I do this? And part of me wants to do that, and part of me wants to do this. No, they're completely, uniformly at peace with themselves and their love for Krishna. That's the spiritual world. And not only do they love Krishna in the spiritual world in Vrindavan, but it's in a specific mood. Just like in the king's court, the trusted guards and ministers, at least theoretically, they have great respect and love for the king, but it's in a particular mood. He's their king. He's the representative of power, and they are his servants in his power. But in Vrindavan, the fact that he's all-powerful, Krishna is all-powerful, again, the same person with the crown, on the throne, in the court. Same person with the same power, but the mood is different. And the mood of those who love him is different. They love, they know that he's the Supreme Lord, but they don't exactly care that he's Supreme Lord. They just love him for his nature. They're not, they don't have, they don't love him because he's the all-powerful fulfiller of all desires. They just love him because he's just so wonderful, as one would expect the absolute truth, the Supreme Lord, to be wonderful. Who would be more wonderful than him? Who would be more beautiful than him? Who would be more clever than him? Who would be more powerful than him? So they just love him for his personality, for who he is, not for his all-powerful position. They just love him. So because they love him with such completeness, so fully, how they naturally, spontaneously give themselves to Krishna. Therefore, he is captured by their love. He reciprocates with their love. So in the 11th chapter of the 10th canto, which describes this intimate, most intimate realm of Vrindavan, there's one little pastime when Krishna is just very, very little. And some of the elderly gopis means the ones who take care of the cows. They're a cowherd community. Because everyone there, they love the cows. They're in that community, Albira. They love the cows. And so one of the gopis, the elderly gopis, says, little baby Krishna says, Krishna, if you dance, I'll give you a half of a sweet. Now, he's the all-powerful Supreme Lord, and yet in the hands of this, by this request of this elderly gopi who loves him so much, the little boy begins, in an awkward, clumsy way, perhaps, but he begins to dance for the half of the sweet. All the gopis get around and encourage him and clap, and he's dancing, moving his hands. And he's, because of their love, he assumes the mood, the all-powerful Lord assumes the mood like a little boy who's awkwardly dancing. He who's controlling every atom in the universe through his energies, who's the supreme possessor of all wealth, all opulence, all strength, all knowledge, he's dancing for half of a sweetheart. So this is the inconceivable land of Vrindavan, because he's captured by the love of the residents of Vrindavan. But yet, Krishna leaves Vrindavan on a particular level, because reality is multi-leveled. It's not just one level. So he's always in Vrindavan on one level, and on another level he leaves. And the residents of Vrindavan associate with him on the level that he's always in Vrindavan. He leaves Vrindavan, but he's always in Vrindavan on another level. But they associate with him on the level where he is always in Vrindavan by the power of their love in missing him, in separation. That Krishna has left. Oh, when will Krishna return? And I remember when Krishna did this and Krishna did that and Krishna did this and we did this together, and remember when we... And by that, always thinking about Krishna, they actually fully associate with him because of their love for him. So that's on one level of what's going on. All the residents of Vrindavan are with Krishna continuously, and he never leaves Vrindavan. But on another level, he does leave Vrindavan. So, of course, naturally, this is... things in the spiritual realm are somewhat inconceivable to our material consciousness, which is finite and very limited. It's limited by experience. So yesterday we began speaking about Krishna's leaving Vrindavan and how completely devastated the residents of Vrindavan were. And in their missing him, it was like their life had left their bodies. So what's left of the body when the life, the soul, the prana, leaves the body? It is no life. It can't do anything. So when Krishna left, because Krishna was their life, this is what love of God is. What he becomes your life. He becomes everything for you, and without him, you have nothing. You are nothing in the sense that you don't feel like you. It's like if you have a great wealth and you lose it, you feel like I don't exist anymore, practically speaking. So, when one has this depth a love for Krishna. Krishna is one's life. So Krishna was the life of the residents of Vrindavan. So on one hand, when he left, they were crying and crying, devastated and stunned and unable to do anything. And in that ecstasy of missing him, they were with him, and they were ecstatic. But externally, it looked like complete misery. But on another level, Krishna was left, and while the residents of Vrindavan were crying, the residents of Mathura, they got to see Krishna. So they came awake, they got their lives. Because before that, they were hearing all the time, Krishna's in Vrindavan, Krishna's in Vrindavan. Oh, what is he doing there? He's doing this, he's doing that. So now they were getting a chance to see him, he whom they had heard about for so long, about his beauty, his strength, his intelligence, his attractiveness. So we heard how Akura, who had on his chariot brought Krishna and Balaram to Vrindavan, how he wanted to take Krishna home with him, naturally. He had been with Krishna, the supreme, all-attractive person. And Krishna had said, I have to do something now. So you go about your duties. You can return to your home in Mathura. So, and Akura offered prayers and begged Krishna, please, I've just attained you. I'm just with you, and now you're telling me to leave? How is that possible? It's like winning the lottery, and you've won it for 7 hours, and then you lose it immediately. It's worse than never having it at all. There's a saying that one of the acharyas use, the teachers use it in Sanskrit. It's like if you meet Krishna. And then he leaves you. It is like a flash of lightning at night, because suddenly it's nighttime and you can't see, and then the lightning flashes, and for a moment you're alive, you can see, you're with Krishna, but then in a flash. And then the darkness is even denser. It's even deeper than before the lightning flash. So similarly, that's what Krishna is seeing. Krishna is compared like if he disappears. And then disappears meaning one disappears from one's vision. So Krishna, in one sense, he deals with all the devotees in a very individual way. And sometimes, like we're chanting japa, and suddenly we're able to hear Krishna's holy names, and it's the most wonderful experience, and it's so, even at our own lower level perhaps. And then suddenly, and we think, oh, now I can do this. And then suddenly, boom, we lose the ability. And then we think, oh, that was so amazing. And now I can't do it, and one feels very bereft. So what the residents of Vrindavan or the devotees, when anything happens like that, they just more deeply and deeply and deeply take shelter of Krishna. Oh, Krishna, how could I be without you for a moment? How can I? There's one pastime in the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam that describes how Narada Muni, it's in the first canto of the Bhagavatam, that Narada Muni, when he was before he was a great, great sage, he was just a little boy, a baby sage, and he got received when he was very, very young. He received some instructions from great holy men, the Bhakti Vedantas. And they taught him for 4 months, and he served them. He was a little boy. They were elderly. He served them. And then at some point, they left. And he wanted to go with them. Just a young boy, but he was an orphan boy. He just had his mother. He wanted to go with them, but he couldn't because of it. His mother needed him, and he had so much affection for her. But then, one day, there was a tragedy. The tragedy was that the boy's mother, Narada's mother, went out early in the morning to milk a cow, and a snake came. Yes. And she died. It was a tragedy. So he wasn't happy, but yet he saw within this difficulty, this greatest difficulty, there was a seed of mercy and blessing in it. In that darkness was some light. So he saw this, difficult as it was. He had no other person to depend on, and he was just a child. But he saw in that, he saw there must be some mercy of Krishna's. And he just left home. He left the area. His mother was gone. And he just wandered, taking the instructions that the Bhaktivedantas had given him. And he just wandered and wandered and wandered. And he did that for years. And he experienced life in all its varieties. He wandered to beautiful places in forests. He wandered through cities. He saw the good. He saw the bad. He depended on Krishna. Sometimes he got fed. Sometimes he was hungry. Sometimes he drank the water from crystal clear lakes. Sometimes he was thirsty. Sometimes people told him to go away. Sometimes people welcomed him. That's what life is like. It's always this mixture of favorable, unfavorable, good, bad. But what Narada was learning throughout all this experience was to remain very steady inside despite these externals of good and bad that he was experiencing. So he was learning to be steady. So one day he was in a forest that was very beautiful, and he sat himself down under an aswata tree, a banyan tree, and he began to meditate. And in his meditation, he summoned up the Lord in his heart, and he was already quite expert at this, so he was able to do this through the power of his focused mental concentration. But instead of, at this particular time, instead of the Lord coming more or less through his concentration and through his mind, instead, he had what they would call in Sanskrit shakshad darshan. The Lord actually appeared in his heart. And suddenly, when the Lord appeared in his heart, he went mad. His senses, each of his senses, became completely involved in the Lord. With his eyes, he was seeing him within his heart as he actually appeared. With his nose, he was smelling the fragrance, the transcendent. He was touching transcendence in its most intimate aspects, the form of the Lord. He was seeing, he was fully engaged like that, and he was ecstatic, and he was absorbed, fully absorbed in every aspect in the Lord who had appeared in his heart. And then just as suddenly as the Lord appeared, he was gone. immediately Narada stood up. He jumped up as if, as one would naturally do if one loses the most valuable thing of one's life. He had gotten it, and then he lost it. He jumped up, and then he sat down and tried to recapture the Lord in his heart, but he couldn't do it. What he had done before, he couldn't do now, because it was a gift before, and he was trying now to do it by his power. So he was trying and trying, and he couldn't do it. And then he heard a voice which said, there were a few words that the voice said, and the first one, I happen to know the Sanskrit, Hantasmin Janmani Bhavam Namam Drastu. You cannot see me again. Namam Drastu Ivarati. Ivarati means you cannot, because there's a part of you that doesn't deserve to see me again. What you got was mercy. Ivapakwa, because you are not mature yet, fully mature yet. Kasayanam, and there's some impurity in your heart still. Tadarsayam kuyogina. And then the Lord said some other things, and then it was gone. And from that point on, Narada Muni just chanted and chanted and chanted and chanted and chanted and chanted. He kept wandering. But the intensity of his meditative absorption became completely focused. And he didn't care, lokabaya, he didn't care what anyone thought, practically speaking, he just became focused. And in that way, the immaturity and the impurities that may have contaminated or inhabited his heart by this constant chanting and focus of desire, associating with the Lord through the holy names continuously by chanting his glories, etc., he became so pure, and he developed internally and spiritually to such a degree that the Bhagavatam describes that when it was time, and he passed the rest of his life like this, and when it was time for him to leave this world, for his body to drop to the ground, he had already internally cultivated his spiritual existence, his spiritual body. So it describes in the Bhagavatam that he just like lightning and the sound occur simultaneously, so similarly, at the dropping of his body, his spiritual body was instantaneously there, because it was already developed, he had already cultivated it. So that's really what our life is meant for. Whatever gifts we have gotten spiritually, and we should take them very seriously and very deeply cultivate quite an intense desire to become spiritually perfect in this life. Of course, this is something that we aspire for, to become so focused, to become so serious in spiritual life. This is what we aspire for, our consciousness remains internally. We may have to do so many things in the world, but internally our focus remains focused, remains fixed. And then that cultivates or develops our spiritual existence. And that can be realized even now, regardless of the externals of our life or our body, if we have this type of internal focus. So when Krishna told Akura to, you can go home now, because there's something I want to do. Akura very reluctantly he left, and then Krishna did just what he wanted to do, and this is what happened next. Lord Krishna desired to see Mathura. So towards evening, it was late afternoon, towards evening, he took Lord Balaram and the cowherd boys with him and entered the city. Because after all, Krishna was just a village boy coming from the rural towns, and to go to the big city in that mood was quite wonderful, so he wanted to see. But of course, much goes on that's deeper than that. But the Lord saw Mathura with its tall gates and household entrances made of crystal, its immense archways and main doors of gold, its granaries and other storehouses of copper and brass, and and its impregnable moats, beautifying the city with pleasant gardens and parks. The main intersections were fastened of gold and with guild halls and many other buildings. Mathura resounded with the calls of peacocks and pet turtle doves, like pigeons, who sat in the small openings of the lattice windows and on the gem-studded floors, and also on the column balconies and on the ornate rafters in front of the houses. So it was an opulent, extremely opulent city. These balconies and rafters were adorned with stones, precious stones and diamonds, crystal, quartz, sapphires, corals, pearls, and emeralds. All the royal avenues and commercial streets and flower gardens, all the royal avenues and commercial streets were sprinkled with water, as were the sides of roads and courtyards. And flower gardens, newly grown sprouts, parched grains, and rice had been scattered about everywhere. So sometimes in India you see when on festival days the houses are decorated in wonderful ways, and of course not with the gold and jewels and precious stones, but you see they have lamps and banana tree stalks, and they put up gates and they have ghee lamps, and there's sounds and there's bells ringing, and the atmosphere when these things are going on and the prayers are being recited and when these very auspicious and pure elements are present, the whole atmosphere becomes very rarefied and pure. And naturally, when the atmosphere has these auspicious items and the atmosphere is auspicious, you feel happy. The consciousness is uplifted. I notice this. We're not taught these things so much, but everyone notices it. If you walk past, in the United States they call it a bar, or in Australian England it's a pub or something like that, and I can feel it. There's like this a wave of ignorance, of darkness. You know, this feeling of dullness comes out of there. Or if you walk into a lawyer's office, this is the atmosphere. Immediately you feel like going to sleep or something like that. No offense to Tolbert, she's there. As opposed to doctor's offices, which are so nice. But different places carry their own atmosphere according to the activities that are done there. So a holy area that's very, very, very clean and worship is being done there. It has a feel to it, an atmosphere that's uplifting, and a park that's very, very well kept, and it's sattvic, or in the mode of goodness, and these things affect our consciousness. So the city of Mathura, even though it was a city, was very auspicious. Gracing the house's doorways were elaborately decorated pots filled with water, which would be decked with mango leaves smeared with yogurt and sandalwood paste and encircled by flower petals and ribbons. Beautiful, too. So the consciousness is uplifted. Near the pots were flags, rows of lamps, bunches of flowers, and the trunks of banana and betel nut trees. And then the women of Mathura, so Krishna and Balaram and his friends, the coward boys, they began wandering through Mathura. So that's the first description of what they saw. So the women of Mathura hurriedly assembled and went forth to see the two sons of Vasudeva as they entered the city on the king's road, surrounded by their cowherd boyfriends. So the boys and Krishna and Balaram and all the ladies had heard about Krishna, and they immediately assembled hurriedly. Some of the women, my dear king, because Maharaj Prickett is the king who's hearing this, eagerly climbed to the roofs of their homes to see them. Some of the ladies, they were so eager to see beautiful... We mentioned this yesterday, and I can't think of a better way to say it. Just try to conceive of what unlimited beauty is. How beautiful is unlimited beauty? Krishna possesses unlimited beauty. His hair is beautiful. Everything is, it's transcendental. Now, how do we conceive of something transcendental? Transcendental means beyond. We see matter here. Everywhere we see matter, we're used to seeing matter. But what is spiritual energy? What does it look like? How does it feel to be in the presence of spiritual energy? We can get a glimpse of it sometimes as we chant or we see the deities. But how do we conceive of what unlimited beauty is like, of someone who's unlimitedly beautiful? Is he 2 times more beautiful than the most beautiful person we've seen? 5 times more beautiful than the most beautiful person we've seen? 100 times more, 1,000, 1,000,000 times? No, it's completely on a different level, Krishna's beauty. And therefore, he's known as the all-attractive. So having heard, the ladies of Mathura, having heard that Krishna, who they had been hearing about, because Vrindavan and Mathura are relatively close, they had been hearing about Krishna. For years they've been hearing Krishna did this, and he's so beautiful. So when they heard that he had actually arrived in the city of Mathura, they were so eager to see him that they rushed. Some of them, they ran into the streets, some of them rushed to the roofs of the houses. And some of the ladies, in their eagerness, they put their clothes and ornaments on backwards. And others forgot one of their earrings or ankle bells. And others applied makeup to one eye, but not the other. I don't know if any of you have ever had this type of experience in eagerness, but... they forgot themselves. They were so eager because they wanted to see Krishna. So those who were taking their meals, they were eating. That sets natural enthusiasm. And there's one verse that's recited by Sri Ramananda Roy in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Tatra muyam api Tatya lolyam apimulam ekalam janmakoti sukritar nalabhite. That the price of actually being with Krishna is this loyam, or intense eagerness. Tatya lolyam apimulam ekalam. This is the one price that if one is completely eager to be with Krishna, then one needs no other qualification. Because that one qualification of intense, sincere, full desire is like Tivrena Bhakti Yogini Jaita Purusha. It is like the moving of the Ganga near Gomukh. Have any of you ever been to Gomukh, the source of the Ganga? I have. And you've never experienced cold water unless you've bathed in Gomukh. Because that's the source of the Ganga. You see the ice cave where it comes from, and the water has huge icebergs in it and boulders. It's moving so fast that there are boulders that are being moved, and it's so cold. The only way you can bathe there is when there are other people with you. And everyone says, yes, we're going to bathe, and you can't be the only one who doesn't like cold water. But it's so cold, the water is so cold, you don't know whether it's hot or cold. And if you want ever have a pleasant feeling, bathe in Gomukh and then get out of the water. You join. But you feel so happy when you get out. And you don't know if your skin is burning or if it's... Anyway, I've done it once. It's not the kind of thing you do every day. And it was so interesting. It's quite desolate up there. We went on the appearance day of Mother Ganga, actually. So it was an especially auspicious day. And there was a group of students, and the altitude is very, very high there. And the air is very thin. And there was a group of students who were very boldly, they went up to the forest on the next plateau above Gomukh called Tapavan. And then one of the students died because of altitude. Well, the oxygen is very thin, and then the heart starts beating faster, and then it's heavy. So he actually died. So we saw him. They were carried him down. He had gone up, you know, to having an adventure, and it didn't work out. And also, it was very... and also, the other thing I remember, other than the... is that there were these goats, mountain goats, up on the hills above us. And we were down, and they were kicking rocks at us all the way down. What are these foreigners doing here? Something like that. It felt like that anyway. So Tivrena Bhakti Yogena Yajeta Purusha Para. If one is eager, it is compared to Vrena. If one performs devotional service with great intense eagerness, it is compared to the fast moving Ganga that is so powerful, it can move big boulders out of its path. So we may have boulders of limitations and things that aren't suitable for deep spiritual life, but if our intensity of desire is strong enough, Tivrena Bhakti Yogena Yajeta Purushapara, then all the obstacles will be moved away by that. So The ladies of Mathura, continuing. Okay, so those who were taking their meals abandoned them. They were so eager. And others went out without finishing their bathing properly. And women who were sleeping at once rose when they heard the commotion. And mothers breastfeeding their infants simply put them aside. So none of the mothers should imitate these kind of things. But yet their eagerness, their attachment was so fully focused on Krishna. This is like on the highest level of spiritual desire. And that's one thing about Krishna consciousness that we must learn, that there should be no pretension, there should be no imitation. We can just be at the level that we are and progress in a gradual way. So then, the lotus-eyed Lord, so Krishna is called Aravinda Lochana, which means his eyes are like lotuses. So his Krishna's eyes, they're pinkish, and they're shaped like a lotus petal. Oops. Like a lotus petal. They're very long and they're shaped like this. And they come almost to his ears. And he's so beautiful. And he has beautiful hair and his smiling face and his darkest complexion and his transcendentally powerful effulgence or charisma. Charisma literally means power. Power. So he's effulgent, he's bright, effulgent and attractive. And his lips are reddish, his eyes are reddish, his forehead is broad. He's so beautiful. So the lotus-eyed Lord, smiling as he recalled his bold pastimes, he captivated those ladies' minds with his glances. So as they looked at him, he would look at them and just make quick eye contact as he would walk down the road. Very, because things are very, very subtle and sweet. So in this way, just by that touching of his eyes with their glances, he captivated their minds. He walked with a gait, with the way a lordly elephant walks. So, because we don't usually have an experience of elephants walking. Do they have elephants in the zoo? Andrew, so, did you ever see an elephant walk? Yes? Okay, what would characterize how an elephant walks? Huh?
Very gentle.
Very gentle. In what sense do you mean?
I've heard that elephant can put his feet on the egg and will not break it without breaking. He's very sensitive.
I never heard that one, but okay. But of course he couldn't stand on the egg without breaking it. but they sort of move from side to side as they're walking, sort of very, very slowly. One would have to say that he was very cool. You know, just very, very perfect, confident, sort of slowly moving this way, that way as he stepped, looking at everyone, just very beautiful, peacock feathers still on his head. And he walked with the gait of a lordly elephant, creating a festival for the eyes of the ladies who watched him with his transcendental body. His body was like a festival, which is the source of all pleasure for the goddess, the divine goddess of fortune. The ladies of Mathura had repeatedly heard about Krishna, and thus, as soon as they saw him, their hearts melted. They felt honored that he was sprinkling upon them the nectar of his glances and his broad smile. So he would glance at them and just give them a knowing smile. And they were he had them. And he was so beautiful. They were felt honored that he glanced at them and smiled at them. And taking him into their hearts through their eyes, they embraced him, the embodiment of all ecstasy. And as their bodily hairs stood on end in ecstasy, they forgot their unlimited distress caused by his absence. Because life in this world is so incomplete unless we are connected to that person who we are all meant to be connected to, the Supreme Lord. So we go through life with feeling something essential to me is missing. And whether one is a materialist or a spiritualist, everyone has this internal crisis going on. And we try to fill up the missing part with so much matter in different forms, material experiences, and nothing quite gives us the satisfaction that we were longing for and we had hoped it would give. The material world is the place of false advertising, in the sense is there is the promise that if you get this, if you buy this, if you win this, if you purchase this, if you possess this, if you experience this in the material world, then you will find the happiness that you're longing for. But it's just advertisement. It's that the pleasure is in the anticipation. What does that mean? How do you translate that into Hebrew? The pleasure is in the anticipation. Yes. Yeah. Everyone agrees. Everyone agrees on something. This is wonderful. But that's where the happiness is, the anticipation. And then when it's actually there, there's what's left with the same incompleteness. So because the thing that we actually that completes us is our relationship with Krishna, with the Supreme Lord. So they took him into their hearts through their eyes. Just by seeing his form, he entered their hearts. And there they embraced him, the embodiment of all ecstasy. And as their bodily hair stood on end, they forgot their unlimited distress caused by his absence. So everyone in this world is really suffering from absence of Krishna. And then as one gets to be very old and nearing death, then there's such a tendency to be cynical. Cynical means that there's nothing of value, and why everything's bad, and everything, life is just sour and rotten and miserable. Sometimes it doesn't wait for old age, it waits till you're 12 or something like that in Kali Yuga. But the solution is somehow or another, if we can develop our relationship with the Supreme Lord, then we are complete. That is actually who we are. Okay, so we'll just read one more verse and we'll stop. This is still talking about the ladies. Their lotus faces were blooming with affection, because when one is in love, then one becomes more beautiful. Because, yes, when one is happy, then one becomes more beautiful. And when One is miserable, one becomes less beautiful. So it's, yeah, so sometimes we see people that are really glowing inside. They have said something very, very deep in their hearts, and regardless of their physical features, they radiate such depth of beauty that it's very appealing. So the ladies, their lotus faces blooming with affection. The ladies who had climbed to the roofs of the mansion, of the houses, the big houses, they were there. So beautiful Krishna is Balaram, Krishna's walking with the gait of an elephant, slowly glancing at everyone. And the ladies on the roofs, they rain down showers of flowers upon Lord Balaram and Lord Krishna. So what a scene. Rose petals and fragrant flowers were coming down, and Krishna is walking in his wonderful way, smiling and glancing at everyone. Okay, we'll stop here. And then Krishna willing, not tomorrow, but on tomorrow's Friday. Yeah, we have a special event planned for tomorrow, but not this special event. We have another special event. I think we continue on Monday, yes? Okay. Thank you very much. Why don't we have 10 seconds worth of questions? Sorry to my watch, it's almost 8. Does anyone have a very fast question? Yes? No? Okay, anyone have a question? Okay. A binary question so I can...
See Krishna with their material eyes? How is it possible?
We cannot see Krishna with our material eyes, but there's a wonderful explanation by Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur like this, on this point, that we don't, when a devotee meditates on Krishna, if he's not on the transcendental platform, he thinks he's meditating on Krishna, but he's not. Because Krishna is beyond the concepts that he has in his mind. So on one level, he's not meditating on Krishna. But on another level, when Krishna sees, and this is the explanation of Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, when Krishna sees that his devotee's attempt, immature as it may be, his heart becomes very soft, and he thinks, oh, my devotee is meditating on me. And he gives him something. Not everything, but he gives him something that is far beyond his ordinary experience. So even though it's not perfect, the attempt is always glorious. And Krishna appreciates the attempt, and he reciprocates with the attempt. Because we're dealing with a person here, a transcendental person who leans towards his devotees, even if the devotees are not mature, fully mature. Is that okay?
Yes, and please, one more thing. Did the ladies of Mathura, did they see him with the material eyes?
No, but see, according to everyone's consciousness, according to your consciousness, you see Krishna in one way or another. So they don't have material eyes, but they'll see, actually they see Krishna in a different mood with a different consciousness than the coward boys see Krishna, and a different mood and a different consciousness that the gopis see Krishna. This will be described later. Krishna, Rasovaisa, that he is the reservoir of all transcendental relationships. So according to your consciousness, you see Krishna differently. But who is seeing Krishna totally? One could say, and you could say actually, but a more complete Krishna, or more beauty of Krishna, the ones who love him the most. Kamsa saw Krishna, but he was simply filled with fear. So was he really seeing Krishna? Well, he was seeing an aspect of Krishna. But when the gopis see Krishna, they see a different Krishna, in one sense. There's a saying in English, love is in the eyes of the beholder. When one is in love, one sees beauty in one's beloved. You follow me? So when one loves Krishna, Krishna reveals more of his beauty. Because he has, again, unlimited beauty. So he, according to the type of love and the capacity, and how much love one has, Krishna reveals more of his beauty. So starting from what you, your first question is that... even the attempt, even though it may be weak and immature, it's still glorious. And it's the same with chanting, too. Or hearing Bhagavatam. When most exalted devotees chant or hear Bhagavatam, they can experience Krishna directly. So we experience something, perhaps. And we could, anandam buddhivardhanam pratipatam, that we can look forward as we mature and mature, and if by Krishna's grace and good association, etc., and sincerity, we become more advanced, we can look forward to an eternally increasing appreciation of Krishna and Krishna's beauty. Okay. Deep questions. So why don't we just have a very, very short kirtan and then we'll end. Did you bring any instruments? Saturday, is that what day? Or is it? Is it? Saturday, okay. We're going to have a kirtan performance. This one second, excuse me. Oh, my leg. Be good, leg, please. What were you going to do? Take it off? Talk to it, preach to it. Okay, no. Yes, no. Okay, we'll sit like this. Here's a drum.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama.
turning into Mathura ki entire world permanently. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Thank you.